All right, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, we have a very special guest, a returning guest for the third time. We're going to discuss more details in his very excellently researched book, Two Masters and Two Gospels. And there's some points that we just haven't gone over in detail in a very detail-oriented book. So Mike, J. Michael Bennett is returning. So Mike, are you there?
Sure am. And thank you for having me back. I hope your listeners can put up with me a little bit more. And be patient. I've got some hard data.
Oh, definitely. And very important. I mean, I think I said in the earlier and other two interviews, this is a different angle than many people would see, and Christians in particular don't have this kind of looking at this facet of kind of modern Christian life. And so I think it's very important that people listen on, but we're trying to pick up from where we last left off last time. I remember we talked about Gerald Hurd and you wanted to kind of pick up at a certain spot. So can you just kind of remind me and the audience where we're at in your book?
Sure. We're going to talk tonight about an aspect of the book I almost really never get asked about in other interviews. So if they've heard me elsewhere, it'll be something hopefully a little fresh to them. I talked on the historical part, which is the main bulk of the book, about the guys who really started the marriage of big business and conservative Christian community, which birthed Christian media back in around 1940. And that was James Fifield and a guy we really didn't talk about much, Howard Kirshner, that did Christian economics. And sort of the murky characters that were connected to them and robber barons that sort of put that all together. And then this last time we talked about the other side of the fence, what I would call the Gnostic element from the other side through Gerald Hurd that brought together the paranormal, New Age techniques, other kind of things from that whole cauldron there in Southern California of the late 30s and 40s. And he added the intellectual component to their Christian media background. Again, totally fish out of water from the conservative side. But while the first generation of Christian media were guys like through spiritual mobilization and James Fifield and also Howard Kirshner in Christian economics, and they dominated the Christian discourse on public issues in the 1950s, 40s, 1950s. And really set the table for what we know as Christian libertarianism, which is this, idea not having assistance for people or jobs programs or anything to get people on their feet, but basically a pro-business wealth class message. But the second generation of Christian media is what I want to talk about tonight, which is sort of what bridged from like the 1950s to the 1970s. And the guys who actually trained the people that some of your listeners may be more familiar with, like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, these kind of people, the guys that worked for them and birthed what we know is the birth of the Christian right in the late 1970s. These guys, probably the main commonality of them was a hardcore fascist bit, very anti-Semitic. Medic bend to it, and that's why I'm going to some details tonight about these people were that dominated in America in that intervening period of time.
Great. So who were those figures for people who might not know their names? Who influenced Falwell and Robertson?
Okay. Well, one of the sources that I used is a place called the Mises Institute from Ludwig von Mises, the father of libertarianism. They're into, you can find this online, paper from Lee Haddon called Christian Thought in the American Libertarian Movement. And he began by talking about a Presbyterian leader, Reverend Carl McIntyre, who was a heavy power player in Christian media in his time. And he had a weekly paper called The Christian Beacon, all the way back to 1936. And he was basically really battled the mutual gospel led to World Council of Churches and things like this. And he tried to label them as just being purely a communist enterprise and formed his own counter organization that was very much a hard right type. And he started something that he's famous called the 20th Century Rubber Maker in 1955. And that's what made him really a household name in America. And but he took this big business message before it began to get to be more of an overtly fascist message. He was reinforcing what spiritual mobilization taught. He said that it was the duty of ministers of the gospel, quote, to remind their congregations of the Christian sanction of individual freedom, untrammeled by the interest from the state, and to take initiative in reestablishing in the minds of men everywhere the validity of profit. Now, for some reason, I guess he felt this holy, eternal calling to defend, which, you know, there's a lot of things you think you could defend as a minister, but this was what he really pushed. As far back as like 1965, the Institution of American Democracy estimated that in the 65 income of this 20th century Reformation hour was over $3 million. And that's in 1965 dollars. While the John Birch Society, who was the other major hard right group of that era, was bringing in about $4 million. Now, just to sort of compare it today, you could multiply those numbers by about 8.5 to actually get a picture of how much money was rolling through these guys' coffers. And that goes a long way to having influence through print media and in the actual video media that they used. And he actually was integrated to the guy who's always seems to be the culprit that I talk about, which was the shale oil tycoon, J. Howard Pugh. While he was bankrolling a lot of this, I found a 1964 letter from one of Pugh's associates imploring him to desist from financing fascist organizations like this and like the John Birch Society. But they went on unimpeded. A lot of his fellow big oil guys were part of this. In fact, I found a quote that from a speech that J.R. Pugh gave for the Christian Freedom Foundation in April 1950, where he said that in Washington, there are many politicians who'll tell you that I am an economic royalist, some who contend that I am a fascist. And this basically financed Christianity today, and all of our main Christian groups today bring their roots back to J. Howard Pugh. And he admitted that his reputation was that he was a fascist. Now, I think I mentioned in a prior show, he was one of the ringleaders in the business plot in 1933 to do a fascist overthrow of FDR.
Where right, so Smedley Butler's book, yeah. Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket.
Butler, the Marine. Right. Now, he also was very involved in financing groups like the Liberty League and also Sentinels for the Republic. Now, one of the interesting things about the Sentinels of the Republic is I found later data that the guy who ran that group, when I went through the library records of J. Howard Pugh at the university, had invited him to come to stay to his camp at Bohemian Grove. And in 1947, I don't know if we talked about this in an earlier show, but
a little bit.
I found the actual internal records of Bohemian Grove where the head of Sentinels of the Republic invited him into the caveman camp. And that was the one where Nixon later was at. But friend Herbert and Herbert Hoover, Hoover was actually there. I'm here with his historian, by the way, Alan on TV a lot. He comes on TV news. There's a book that I found from him called White Protestant Nation. He gave a little more of a picture in Pugh and what he was forming, this sort of totalitarian control he liked. He explained that in the college that he basically bankrolled and operated, Grove City College, J. Howard Pugh said that at a college university, the board of directors should lay a policy in a corporation, and in a college, the board of trustees should lay down the policy, and all members of the faculty should carry out that policy. And he said that, you know, his school, chapel is compulsory, Bible is taught, academic freedom as practice is not tolerated. So these are some of the principles that were in vogue at the time, that academic freedom or any kind of freedom was not tolerated, compared to the guys who had the money. And it's a golden rule where the person with the gold writes the rules. Right. Now, when he was approached with Billy Graham to fund this pet project, Christianity Today, that Billy Graham had, which is the most famous literary work in the Christian world in America. Another paper I found from a Darren Graham for the University of Georgia quotes what happened in interaction of that, that Pew pledged the $150,000 seed money that Billy Graham wanted to start Christianity Today, but Billy Graham had to make the commitment that they would keep up values that was anti-labor, that was anti-workers' rights and things like this. And they were using this as a Christian organ to basically do it. And so he ran this through party, a church. And this church was the one that ran through and sort of cleansed the money and ran it to the Billy Graham Association. So all of this was sort of considered fair play. And transparency was really not what they were really about. Now, something that sort of will transition us into what I want to focus on the overtly fascist generation of guys is I'm going to mention a little bit that probably most listeners here don't know about, of all people, the father of William F. Buckley. Okay. Now, you know Buckley is, right?
Right, of course, yeah. Buckley's dad, Yale.
He was
a God and man at Yale or something? Was William Buckley Jr.
Yeah, well, William
F. Buckley Jr. The father was an oil man, too, right?
Yeah. Did firing line. Right, right. I just want to tell you a few little tidbits about him. It's sort of interesting because and was basically the only really conservative show on for, you know, I don't know, decades maybe, before Rush Limbaugh came along somewhere, you know, after 1988, began to have a national presence. Really born by William. But it's interesting to know some of the background of father. Now, he is very, you know, he wrote God and Man in Yale and came across very pious, Junior did. This Lichtman, they talked about that William Sr. envisioned a political career for his son to combat other conservatives he identified, such as the Young Republican Club, which he said, which I understand is dominated by radicals, mostly Jews. And this is what Buckley Sr.'s view was and what he was trying to steer his son away from to form an alternative conservative movement. Buckley Sr. raised his children in Mexico, including William F. Buckley Jr., South America, London, Paris, and the United States, sending the children to private schools. You know, this is why they can so identify with the common men like you and me.
Right.
This is right. The life as they knew it.
Now, right. Well, just to interject, please continue. Tell yeah. more about Sr. Sorry.
Well, Sr. When he migrated to Mexico in 1908, Buckley Sr. represented U.S. and European oil companies as a lawyer there, and became president of a local oil company. Also appointed a legal counsel by the Mexican president Huerta, who himself had instigated a coup and assassinated the prior president in other topicals, leading to a brief brutal regime until he abdicated and fled into the U.S. until he actually was caught brokering a deal with German intelligence to arm him to overtake Mexico again and then help Germany in a war against the U.S.
Right.
This
a lot of people don't know that the German. Sorry to interrupt, right. But a lot of people don't know that Germany
right.
was meddling with Mexico in World War One. Sorry.
The famous one telegram.
Yeah, telegram.
That right. they were cutting a deal where Mexico would get most of the Southwest back. Probably you're stating right now would have been Mexican
yeah, no territory doubt.
Again in exchange for with the Germans.
Which is really Spanish no, land before that.
That's legit or not.
Yeah, it's Spanish land before
right, that. Before right, right. Now, Buckley Sr. was representing this guy who was trying to work against the U.S. in a deal with the Germans who were fighting at the time. Buckley Sr. then leased oil lands in Mexico, and he was offered to be the civil governor of Veracruz by President Wilson as the U.S. was occupying that. I don't know if you knew that, that William F. Buckley Jr.'s father was in that. Well, he later formed a lobby group to permit Americans to own Mexican land and oil rights to keep the profits out of the hands of the Mexicans, and that their constitution forbid that. So he failed Mexico basically get the rich people in as colonialists to own the Mexican wealth. And so he moved on to cut deals with oil company, Venezuela, and then Israel, Guatemala, and other countries. So it's this kind of elitism that forms the foundation of this era of the movement. Mentioning Reverend Carl McIntyre, and I don't want to spend too much time with him, even though he's very influential, because he wasn't one of the more extreme heavy hitters. But he did found the hard right American and International Councils of Christian Churches, which he used as a lobbying organization. And the show, the 20th Century Reformation Hour, which was on more than 600 stations, we started it in 1955, which is pretty impressive. But one of the big things that I'm notable at with McIntyre, that he brought in within his ranks and groomed this preacher, Billy James Hargis, and his crusade organization in the early 50s. Are you familiar with the name Billy James Hargis?
No.
Well, he's a very, very important. He was the Jerry Falwell in importance of his day. He was the big guy of conservative Christian media in his time. And I'm going to share with you some interesting tidbits about him. Their Christian crusade included a Christian crusade magazine. He had radio and television broadcast. He had training schools for Christian conservatives. Back in the late 60s, he was bringing in over $1 million a year, and his broadcasts were on 500 radio and 250 television stations.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive, even though the historian Lichtman says that in the 1970s, his enterprises would crumble after he admitted having sexual relations with male and female students at a college he'd founded. Now, this was a guy in the hard right who was really pushing what we would call social, culture war kind of things. Moral purity, extreme combating against immorality. And as we'll find out, he was having his students of both sexes at his Christian colleges. Another person that he mentored was a minister. Maybe you've heard of him. Have you ever heard of a Francis Schaeffer?
Yes,
Reverend
that sounds
Francis
familiar.
Schaeffer.
Yeah. He's really
Francis
a theologian,
Schaeffer
right?
Was one of the most influential people in the early days of the religious right. People, he looks like he's from another era, wears a little knee breeches and a little whisker. He did a little book, How Should We Then Live? And a lot of the first early anti-abortion stuff came from him. He was considered this intellectual, philosophical guy. Started the Brie Fellowship in Switzerland. His son was being groomed to take it over and hold against him. But this was another guy who was taught by these people. And
this is him, right?
McIntyre was more of a... Yeah, that's him. You got it. But McIntyre was a pretty hardcore separatist, fundamentalist, Calvinist, Presbyterian. And he was known for these stunts, like to keep in the public eye, like building a full-scale Noah's Ark or a temple of Jerusalem. He even had a seaborne pirate radio station, always getting in trouble with the government for these kind of things. But I want to tell you a little bit about Billy James Hargis, okay? This was, I'm just going to say some things from the obituary he had in the London Guardian newspaper, because he was known internationally. It says, they say, like many other press accounts, the IRS removed his religious organization's tax exemption because of its overt political emphasis. And they noted in 1976 that Time magazine reported that two students from his American Christian College, again, they were like the Bob Jones or Liberty University of their day, okay?
Right.
Two students from his college who married alleged that both discovered that each had lost their virginity to Hargis, while a number of the male choir members accused him of coercing them into sex, justifying his seductions by quoting the example of David lying with Jonathan. And these allegations Hargis had were due to communist and Satan conspiring against him, but he eventually had to resign from the college. And he admitted in his autobiography later that he was guilty of great sin, but he really was the hard right firebrand of fundamentalist Christianity that dominated Christian media in his era and generation. Now, I found a very highly regarded investigative monthly magazine called This Land that comes from the Oklahoma region, and particularly a 2012 work on Billy James Hargis. And they show their evidence that the FBI sought Hargis in connection with the 1959 and 60 bombings in protest of the desegregation of the Little Rock schools. So I don't know if you remember the Little Rock bombs, but yes. Can you imagine a guy like a Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson today being discovered that they were involved in bombing?
It'd be shocking. Hargis was a known segregationist, though, right? Hargis was a known segregationist.
Right. But that was not uncommon. You know, even Jerry Falwell, you know, I got the original press accounts when he founded Liberty, and it was expressly said that it was for white children to get a Christian education. And, you know, I have sermons from Jerry Falwell talking about the curse of Ham and how black people were cursed to be the servants of white men going all the way back to the days of Noah. So, you know, this was a common view, and I would say it's not all that sublimated today, to be honest with you. They also discovered, according to FBI Special Agent Joe Casper, Hargis was planning to bomb the Philander Smith College in Little Rock soon. The preacher had recently met with two other bombing suspects at a Memphis restaurant. And again, they, just like as you were saying, they noted his pro-segregation sermons in affiliation with the pro-segregation Major General Edwin Walker, who was in command of the Arkansas Military District at Little Rock. Has Edwin Walker come up in your discussions on your show in the past?
Not much, but I'm familiar with him. I thought he was really one of the hard riders around the Kennedy assassination in the 60s.
Right. You're very, very warm on that. You're exactly right. But these are the guys who our Christian media people were cavorting with. Hargis preached that the entire civil rights movement was a communist plot, which is what the John Birch Society has always said. While Walker began interacting with the John Birch Society and who were proposing that Eisenhower himself was a communist, the Republican president. Now, for people who don't know about Edwin Walker, while he was commanding all the troops in Germany, Walker was programming them with John Birch materials. And of course, they have to respond to it because he's the commanding officer. Until his anti-government materials were exposed by the press. And President Kennedy warned him that such people equate the Democratic Party with the welfare state, and the welfare state with socialism, and socialism with communist. They object quite rightly to politics intruding in the military, but they are anxious for the military to engage in politics. Now, that's a quote from John F. Kennedy, and obviously that's very clear that nothing has ever changed. If you look at the activities at the Air Force Academy and elsewhere, this view is still alive and well. Now, he was relieved of his command because he refused to stop using these materials. And in turn, General Walker, as a officer, did not even recognize the commander-in-chief that Kennedy was a legitimate president. And so he resigned. And meanwhile, at that time, the main Christian media guy of his time, Billy James Hargis, was nominated to be president of We the People, an organization in 1959, which held this first Tea Party. This Tea Party goes all the way back to 1962. Wow. And he stepped down from the presidency to make way for Ezra Taft Benson, a name.
Right.
Maybe
he's
a
the
name
Mormon prophet, right? The Mormon prophet.
Right. He referred to the South as the Negro Soviet Republic. And in fact, I have some film strips from the John Birch Society I got off archive.org that they would use to teach people in their homes that said that this was part of the great Soviet plan, that they were going to give all of the Southeast, and they have a map showing it, as the Negro Soviet Republic was what they were taught. And now the FBI actually questioned Hargis about the Little Rock bombings and continued to monitor him while in mentioning his book, The Negro Question, Communist Civil War Policy. And he taught that segregation was one of God's natural laws. I'm sorry?
I just said, wow. Like, that's what he published, yeah.
Yeah, and that Martin Luther King was a communist-educated traitor. Now, Hargis and General Walker began a speaking tour together, as Walker soon ran for governor of Texas with H.L. Hunt financing him.
Wow. See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I believe it was called Operation Midnight Ride, and they were touring without the Southeast there in the early 60s. Now, Walker tried to stop the attendance of a black man at the University of Mississippi, and in the resulting riot, 6 federal marshals were shot, and Walker was arrested for sedition and insurrection against the U.S. in 62. But he had an all-white jury there in Mississippi who decided not to indict him, and they didn't call in any of the black witnesses that were there. So when they started this tour, Billy James Hargis and Walker started Operation Midnight Ride, which was sponsored by the Ku Klux Klan in South Carolina and Arkansas. Hargis told the New York Times that most of his funding came from oil companies.
There you go. Wow.
Now, yeah. Now, in Los Angeles, the John Birch Society presented Walker with a plaque calling him the greatest living American. So another tidbit about this general, Walker, was that in 1963, supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald fired into Walker's home right about the time of the assassination, barely missing him. So this was the story Walker told the authorities, was that Lee Harvey Oswald was trying to attack him.
It's sort of April. It was in April 1963.
Yeah. So it's sort of curious that he would have to try to build this story in the press, distancing himself from Lee Harvey Oswald. True. Now, by November 17th, 1963, Billy James Hargis, Walker, and George Wallace were speaking in Dallas in opposition to Kennedy, with Walker was running ads denouncing him in the Dallas Morning News. And then, of course, the president was assassinated there 5 days later. Now, if I remember right, the ads actually showed like a little bullseye on on President Kennedy. And this was a few days in Dallas when they were doing this.
And they're all there. All these guys, Walker and H.L. Hunt, were connected. These guys are all around the assassination of Kennedy. Farthest right.
Well, you know. This is sort of off the record and off of my book. It's going to be dovetailed into my next volume, but I'll give you a little scoop here. I've been going through the FBI records of Willis Carto,
right,
who has been one of the more prominent anti-Semitic Holocaust deniers of the last, you know, number of decades. It really has built what we now know as the neo-Nazi community. And Willis Carto and a few others, including the man who I had outed as R.C. Christian, I found him deep in the bowels of the records. You know, they built the Georgia Gadstones.
Right.
Was part of this group. But believe it or not, that these supposedly Christian conservative meetings they were having, they had FBI plants in the meeting. And I found the file records. This was like in October 1963, where they had militant groups there planning to assassinate all of our political leaders there.
Say that one more time. They were going to assassinate American political leaders where?
They were in America. I mean, president on down. And they were already using these, like, Christian meetings, conservative meetings, to plan it.
To plot, I see.
Right, right. And the FBI received all these records, and they were actually tracking these people. But they were sort of based out of the Texas area.
And did you say that R.C. Christian is a real person, not just kind of fake?
Oh, yeah.
He was the one who was supposedly or ostensibly financed the Guidestones, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And in fact, he wrote a book, Common Sense Renewed. I have a copy of it. I don't know if there's any more floating around. Well, let me amend that. I don't want to give all the thunder away from if people want to go see the documentary I co-produced called Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Gadstones. But I actually have in my safety deposit box the actual design letters in his writing, handwriting from R.C. Christian that I was able to get from the construction people.
Was he a front? Did he finance the whole thing?
Well, he had he called a small group of people that were part of it, although he was a very successful inventor and surgeon where he came from. And the other guy who would sometimes masquerade as this R.C. Christian with him was one of his very best friends, who was the head of the newspaper community in his state and oversaw the overall newspaper community, head of an organization there. And he was the one who would right, there you go. That's the documentary. It's all in there, 2 hours. And it fingers the address, the name of the people who were part of this. So, but I was shocked to find out in the bowels of looking at the attendees of these meetings, and sure enough, there was this gentleman. In fact, there's some evidence at the end of that documentary that there may be a Nobel laureate that was part of that group, too. That was fingered by one of our testifiers. Yeah.
I don't know if you know this. Sorry to interrupt, but I don't know if you know this, but this is highly Masonic. The whole design is totally occult. And so you have these ostensible Christians on the far right associated with making this occult thing that says, you know, you got to kill off the population to have 500 million people. Yeah. So I should tell you a little bit about it. You know.
You'll find in the letters that we had in the construction files that we got our hands on, that the real construction files that were used, there was potentially another pseudo-Christian mystical organization that has a connection to it, and you can see the evidence in the documentary for it. Like materials that appears probably were placed into the, or intended to be placed into the time capsule. So I'll just leave that with you all to look at that. But anyway, not long, this is sort of interesting, not long after the whole Billy James Hargis scandal, where I mentioned how he was outed for bedding the students, both male and female. And these guys were the hardcore macho, hard right Christian movement. You know, General Walker was sort of like the, who's the general today? I write about him all the time. Family Research Council, second in command. I'll think of his name in a minute. He's second in command there under Tony Perkins. But anyway, these real macho guys like this are often where you sort of find this alternative life to them. You know, Hargis was the big macho, big Southern male. You know, we've got to defend women and their purity, and we got to get immorality out of society. And then you find out he's sleeping with young boys and girls.
I can tell a story about William Buckley. If we get back to Buckley, I'd be happy to cover that too.
Well, General Walker, who was, again, Mr. Macho, we got to use force, sort of like what we hear today, same thing we hear today from these guys. Jerry Boykin, by the way, was the name I was trying to come up with.
Boykin.
Anyway, General Walker was caught fondling an undercover policeman in a restroom of a public park in Dallas.
Wow.
And was arrested for public lewdness. Now, he did it twice. And he pleaded no contest to it and paid a fine for it. And they very quietly handled it. And it turns out President Reagan returned Walker after being indicted for sedition. President Reagan turned Walker back to active status in the Army at age 73 with the whole intention for him to enjoy his full military benefits.
Right. So he was a bathroom raider at an old age. It says here 66. And then he got busted the next year. Same thing. Wow.
Right. Right. Yeah. These are our macho guys that are trying to preserve moral purity in our country.
Right.
You know, it's just like what we had with Robbie Zacharias, the Christian philosopher intellectual who, you know,
the great apologist.
We discovered owned a series of massage parlors just recently, and was exploiting women who were financially challenged, like immigrant women that were desperate, and made them offers they couldn't refuse. You know,
it was really bad. Now, actually, Ravi, actually, just to interrupt, one of the things that Zacharias did that I noted that a lot of people didn't know is he had one person he abused and made her, gave her money and made her sign an NDA, and then talked about her poorly, and she couldn't talk back because she had signed the NDA. So he engaged in very sharp, in my opinion, sharp but not in a good way, very scurrilous, in my opinion, legal tactic, and really bad, which is a warning to all listeners, always get a mutual NDA. So that's like one of the things. So she may not have had a good lawyer or a lawyer at all. So it was very, it was the opposite of being a Christian. Like, okay, I'm going to sign you up to an NDA, then I'm going to talk about you, and you can't say anything because you're bound.
Well, that ought to be a red flag. The NDA ought to be a red flag when they offer that.
Well, true.
Jerry Falwell Jr. made all of the senior leadership at Liberty University sign an NDA.
It's probably a one-way NDA, too. I bet it was a one-way NDA.
Yeah. Right, about him. And it became a reign of terror where people were just totally broken because they wanted to expose things, but they were terrified because he would destroy people.
Right. So it gives you all that leeway. It's very devious, man. Very bad.
Right, right. Now, let me just skip on a little bit here to some other people.
Okay, before you go, I got a question from the listener. Okay. Why do you believe the left side doesn't speak about this info more? Because I don't really hear it from the left either. I try to keep abreast of what they're talking about, but this, I don't hear this information about how strange these ostensibly Christian leaders, far right leaders, are.
Well, you know, that's an excellent question, and it really is buried. I mean, this information is buried, and that's what motivated me to spend, I can't tell you the hours I've spent digging for this material. I mean, I was using books from anywhere from the 19-teens to the 1950s that recorded information that's long since been buried and forgotten. And it is amazing that they don't know enough. Now, you know, I've used like organizations like The Intercept, for example, which some would call a left investigative arm. You know, they're the ones that exposed that this guy that was doing these purity balls. And I'm writing about that in one of my other books, too. This is Kay Hiramine, who was running these purity balls where these girls would dance lasciviously for their fathers who would be their dates. And it's a big thing in Colorado Springs and places like that. And they'd say, "Daddy is my date," and sit on his lap and stuff like that. Well, he ran a, quote, ministry, this ministry for relief, including in North Korea. And The Intercept outed the fact that underneath the Bibles he was taking into North Korea was military equipment to monitor nuclear weapons and other weaponry and to have caches of material in case we invaded North Korea for this Christian ministry underneath the Bibles they were smuggling in. And the guy who was evidently running the operation was what I had later, by connecting the dots and other research, was one of his best friends, which was General Boykin. Wow. You know, the guy who oversaw Black Hawk Down, and he was the head of all special forces. Well, he was the head of all military intelligence. And this was his idea as a hardcore Christian leader. And he's, again, second in command in Family Research Council. But his idea was to have a fake Christian ministry so they would be left alone and use this to smuggle military weaponry inside the country.
Wow. That's
now, you wonder why we have these communist regimes crack down hard on churches and distrust them, you know, and they want to put plants in there to see what they're doing because they're afraid they're CIA outlets. When we let these guys do this kind of stuff, we play into the hands of these regimes who say, "Look, we've caught you red-handed doing this kind of stuff." And it should be heartbreaking. And as a Christian, I'm incredibly incensed. And why this guy is invited to be a keynote speaker in all of these major churches, including like the Calvary Chapels that I used to go to at you know, these, what was the one with the men's meetings that they had, you know, X number of years. These guys are heroes. You know, we have at our main church in this area, we have Oliver Northcomb.
Right.
And, you know, he's the great speaker there, although he was caught red-handed brokering a deal to get weapons to the Iranians, and he was getting personal remuneration for it.
And involved in coke. I mean, he had to know the coke deals were going on.
Well, and he was...
I mean, in my opinion, I should say that's my opinion.
He was indicted on it and found it, and he got off on a loophole. Not that he was innocent, but he got off on a loophole because he had cooperated in doing other things and providing other information, so they granted him immunity from what he was caught red-handed doing. But some of the other folks that were involved in this, if just to go back to what I was talking about here in this Christian media, one of the big players was Richard DeVos, who was the founder of the Christian multi-level marketing business Amway. And, you know, the father-in-law of Betsy DeVos, who comes from the Prince family, Eric Prince's brother, you know, from Blackwater, sort of a royal family between Amway and Blackwater there. And this is where they began grooming out of these groups like Christian Economics, the guys like Ed McAteer, who was one of the real founders of what we now know as the religious right of the late 1970s. These guys were groomed by all of these people. Another gentleman that I wrote called Colonel Donner was the guy's name. He was one of the big three that founded the Religious Roundtable and the Religious Right. He was personally trained by Billy James Hargis in all of the dirty tricks to build like a hard right movement, Christian movement. He admits later, he's repented of all this, but he was actually brought in to do that. Now, I mentioned that Billy Graham had made these commitments to J. Howard Pugh to make Christianity Today, if he would bankroll it, if Pugh would bankroll it, that it would be very much an anti-labor, pro-business kind of message. And in fact, this reference I cite mentioned specific editorials that targeted organized labor, says that, quote, labor forces illegitimate restrictions on capital and gets in the way through government coercion, and would just besmirch. I have a long list of quotations of what they did, but they actually did what they were asked to do. And they probably sprinkled even a little bit of Christianity in there, too. Now, what's interesting is I actually found on some of these early organizations like Christian Economics, I found CIA kept files on these groups. And they would have people like Alan Dulles actually write for these Christian organizations. Now, I've found much about J. Edgar Hoover writing for them as well. And Pew, in the records I have on Pew, he would kiss up to J. Edgar Hoover all the time, trying to out people in his own ranks as communist or other Christian leaders, other church groups as communist, to try to get in the good graces of Hoover. And Hoover would actually, in the letters and correspondence, tell him to back off, that, you know, that these other people had rights and you couldn't actually say that they were communists outright. But he was a real firebrand. But they have guys like Alan Dulles, who would sort of implant what the CIA agenda is and sort of put it into the mind of Christians. A lot of the stuff was pro-colonial stuff, where they're talking about the savage Africans. And in the good days, the what they called the investor nations of the white Anglo-Saxons. And this is in Christian, conservative Christian publications. Had the good days, it says, after 1918, they write in these Christian organizations, colony became a bad word over vast reaches of earth. And they were trying to say, we need to go back to an era of colonialism again. Yeah. And so,
and they really were an era of colonialism. If you look like the Devil's Chessboard in Dulles, they overthrew so many countries after World War II. It's off the charts, including the U.S. in 63, in my opinion. Yeah.
And Africa continued to suffer from that kind. Before that, you know, from the Great Game up to World War I, and it continued after that period of time as well, too. You know, the blood diamonds, all that kind of stuff, too, that was going on. Now, there was a group, you ask about the left. There's there's a group that's probably considered leftist called the World Student Christian Federation. In July 1980, now remember, it's a Christian organization. July 1980, they wrote a paper I got a hold of called Whose Gold is Behind the Altar? Corporate Ties to Evangelicals. Now, this is before the religious right really took off. This is as it was just being germinated. There was no internet. Cable TV really hadn't taken off. So this was in just the very seed era of it. And they were talking about how big Christian media was getting at this time. Okay, so they didn't have the kind of sources we had, including the IRS was not tracking a lot of this information. So they can only get like a tiny, tiny portion of the information on the wealth of these organizations. And what I'm going to tell you are numbers in $1980 dollars. So you need to multiply these at least by, say, three or four to get, the kind of thing they're talking about. So before you even had the advent of cable and the prosperity gospel guys, they focused on evangelical organizations with a constituency of 100,000 or more and with revenues of $2 million or more. And they found 28 organizations that way. Now, of the 20.5 million given to these Christian organizations, three quarters of it, or 15.5 million, just came from Nelson Bunker Hunt alone.
Wow.
And almost all of that went to Campus Crusade. Now, what it also notices is that one of the main sponsors of Jerry Falwell, who's a known Baptist teetotaler, non-drinker, one of his main bankrollers was the Coors Beer family.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if you knew that the Coors family was a big funder of a lot of these Christian media, particularly ones that had a pro-business, anti-labor message. But the Billy Graham Association had a major funding from the Mormon Marriott family. And, of course, a lot of them also, William Randolph Hearst was a big one. Now, I write a lot about the Coors family, and I won't talk about it here, but they were the main bankroller of Ronald Reagan's entire political career. The Coors family is what made Ronald Reagan. Now, they're reviled in Colorado because they have some of the worst worker rights of any country I've ever heard of in America, and just very anti-worker safety, anti-union. They're known for poisoning the water in Colorado and have been sued. And
they're
fact,
supposed to be. That's mother, why they're in Colorado. That was their big selling point, was the fresh water of Colorado, right?
Right.
And so they're there.
Well, they've dumped all sorts of aluminum byproduct in there and made it cancer-causing from the records that I had. And what they did was they went and got the people to put in, like, you remember James Watt, the Interior Secretary?
Yes.
A lot of these guys came from Coors family recommendations to Reagan. And the lawyer they had represent them to sort of sweep all this under the rug was the mother of Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court guy.
It just doesn't go away, right? The DeVos family, Gorsuch, they're all there right now.
These are the people running it behind the show. Now, in the interviews that were published of these family, it immediately becomes clear that the Coors family is an incredibly dysfunctional family of just people who have way, way too much money, full of adultery, absolute contempt for common folks speaking against them. But they're loved in the Christian community because they're really into Bible prophecy, support a lot of Christian ministries, but their life is anything but Christian. Widespread alcoholism amongst the founding family members. Suicide is commonplace. Like I said, just super dysfunctional. And in the quotes from the brothers, who really the founders, of course, they talk about how slavery was good for Black people, and that was a good day for Black people in their slavery. This is what they're telling reporters.
Right.
And that Indians had it too easy on the reservation. Now, Joseph Coors, the main founder, worked with Oliver North to get money to the Nicaragua Contras and went around our congressional laws. And he was a big part of the Iran-Contra hearings, giving them airplanes and things like that. I don't know if you were aware of that.
No.
But, back in this era, 1980, which has only grown many, many fold since then, was that the National Religious Broadcasters, a group that has been run out of here, in fact, I had a little protest prayer time outside of actually bringing in ex-CIA, the directors in to direct the Christian ministries on what the intelligence people would like them to preach on their Christian media about against anti-Sharia and against Muslims. And all the Christian leaders and media were there to take notes from the CIA directors at the National Religious Broadcasters meeting while I was there. Well, in 1980, they already had 900 member TV and radio organizations that had documented 129 million listeners and viewers each week, with 1,400 of the nation's 8,000 radio stations being owned by the National Religious Broadcasters. And adding up to, and being at that point a $1 billion industry in 1980 dollars. And the top televangelists, even before cable came along, were bringing in from $30 to $60 million each in 1979.
Wow, it's a huge number. It's just incredible.
Now, in 1962, a similar thing shows what was going on in Christian media during the era of Billy James Hargis, like you're showing there. Now, his guy who sort of tootled him, Carl McIntyre, his 20th Century Reformation Hour was pulling over in $1.1 million in 1962 dollars, which you should multiply by like 13 or 14 for what it would be today, with the John Birch Society in the same ballpark, also Billy James Hargis's Christian Crusade at the same time. We're a big part of this. Another big person that was involved in this was Gerald L.K. Smith. Are you familiar with Gerald L.K. Smith?
Never heard that name.
He is a very important person for you to know. And if there was one person I'd have a whole show about, it would be him. Yeah, he was a major racist and Holocaust denier, and he was one of the top Christian media figures up through the 1970s. He was in the top tier as well as the Liberty Lobby, which was headed by Willis Carto, as I mentioned earlier, who really built the neo-Nazi movement of today. All of these were tax exempt at the time. These were the big Christian leaders of the 60s. Now, I found a supplement in 1967 that these groups had grown by another 40%. In just the 2 years from 1963 to 65, grown by 40%. Wow. And that money is coming from somewhere. Right. Many, many millions of dollars going into the hands of these people. Part of that money is coming from the people bankrolling them, and the other part of it is coming from the they were popular. I mean, the Christians were eating this up at the time. Now, regarding Gerald L.K. Smith, he's the most important person I'll probably talk about tonight. I found a quotation from a very, very well-known Baptist theologian and leader, Adrian Rogers. Have you heard of Adrian Rogers?
No, I'm not familiar with that name either.
He's considered sort of a god in Baptist circles out of Memphis. I think it's First Baptist Memphis. He's been, I think, the SBC president a number of times. So if it was a Mount Rushmore of conservative Christian leaders, he'd be on it. Well, he gave a sermon in 1984 called God's Way to Health and Wisdom. And he put it also in a book that he wrote. And I want to just quote what he said here. He said, and he became famous for this. He was quoted numerous times and became connected to him. He says, you cannot legislate the poor into freedom by legislating the wealthy out of freedom. What one person receives without working for, another person must work for without receiving. The government cannot give to anybody anything that the government does not first take from somebody else. When half of the people get the idea not have to work because the other half is going to take care of them, and when the other half gets the idea that it does no good to work because somebody else is going to get what they work for, that, my dear friend, is the end of any nation. You cannot multiply wealth by dividing it. Now, it was thought that there was some congressional representative that made that quote that has since been passed around the internet many, many times. The actual originator of it was this Gerald L.K. Smith, who had written it first in his magazine called The Cross and the Flag, which was a very, very popular magazine with Christians. Now, I found a 1964 report by Group Research that talked about Smith and his group, the Christian Nationalist Crusade, and they explained that the principal organizational vehicle of longtime anti-Semite Gerald L.K. Smith in his magazine, The Cross and the Flag, is the official publication of the Crusade, with its first principle listed inside as preserve America as a Christian nation, being conscious of the fact that there's a highly organized campaign to substitute Jewish tradition for Christian tradition. Now, a more clear picture of Gerald L.K. Smith and how he still impacts us today begins in an obituary I found in the New York Times in 1976 for him. Here's a little bit about Gerald L.K. Smith. They say Gerald L.K. Smith, the right-wing Arkansas preacher who once backed Governor Huey Long for president, died today of complications. He was 78. He was with Long when he was assassinated in 35 and cradled the dying governor in his arms. He delivered the oration at his grave. Throughout the 30s and 40s, he was known for his opposition over the radio to Franklin Roosevelt and was the founder of the Christian Nationalist Crusade, a strident right-wing anti-communist organization. He also had his views in his monthly magazine, The Cross and the Flag, in lectures and in 200 small newspapers. Although he was a purveyor of anti-Semitism and other forms of religious and racial bigotry, Gerald L.K. Smith expressed regret that, quote, so many million of my fellow Americans just don't like me. Now, it says that he became a master extremist in 1934 and continued until his death, and seemed mystified that because he was anti-Black, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, and pro-fascist, that he was shunned by many people he would have liked to have known. Now, Mr. Smith was described as by H.L. Mencken, the famous newspaperman, as the greatest rabble-rouser since Peter the Hermit, from the Crusades.
Right.
Now, followers of the Christian Nationalist Crusade paid more than $325,000 through that venue in 67, long after he had reached his peak of power, just for his pamphlets and books, which excoriated the Jew-United Nations, the Black savages ruining our cities, and scores of other targets. Now, he was a fundamentalist minister in the Midwest, but he eventually got big, fancy homes in Los Angeles, Tulsa, and Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And it goes through the incredible amount of wealth he built and had his own printing plant to turn out monthly magazine and other literature labeled by his critics as hate mail. At one point during World War II, the Cross and the Flag was listed by the Justice Department as a propaganda vehicle for alleged seditionists. Mr. Smith temporarily desisted from printing and stopped uttering any more praise of Adolf Hitler. He says, "I'm a bad man." Now, again, this was one of the top Christian media funded guys from the media guys. He says, "I'm a bad, bad fellow," Mr. Smith told an interviewer in 44. "I'm an isolationist. I'm an organizer and leader of America First Party. Oh, put that down, a rabble-rouser. God made me a rabble-rouser. And for the right." Now, the America First Party ran him for president in 1944. And in 1947, he organized the Christian Nationalist Campaign with several other rightist groups. He also ran the Political Tract Society and several other groups. Now, the Christian Nationalists, his platform, called for the deportation of Zionists, the dissolution of Jewish Gestapo organizations, the forced shipment of Blacks to Africa, and the liquidation of the United Nations. His other goals in his political platform and his party were to fight the mongrelizers, the preservation of our Christian faith against the threat of Jew communism, and restore Christian prayer in public buildings, and expose and fight the Black Plague. Now, these are the kind of things you still hear on Facebook and in QAnon stuff and the other groups that we have today. Nothing has changed. There's just this new people that have taken on this message.
Right, but you don't hear the old stuff as frequently now, with these kind of cast of characters.
Right. Well, now, you know, all this information has been repackaged, and later I probably won't get to it, but there are some, the recent head of the American Nazi Party talked about how this gentleman was really the key to to helping build the American Nazi movement in America. Now we know as the neo-Nazi or alt-right.
Was Smith was the key, or Carto? For another person.
Well, Carto, it came after him probably about another 20 years. So the actual groups that are now exist, he was the one who actually named the groups. But the philosophy, the kind of information I'm sharing with you, goes back to Gerald L.K. Smith and another guy who he worked for and joined to help, William Dudley Pelley and the Silver Shirts, which sort of like a brown shirt. Huh?
Gotcha, like an American brown shirt. Are we going to get back to the Buckleys? Because right. I got some good stuff on William Buckley. He's obviously like a cutout or a front or something, because he was not, in his personal life, he was not a Christian at all.
Well, share a little bit. I want to hear a little bit about that.
Well, he's a Bonesman, right? So he was in Skull and Bones. I forgot which year it was, but so he's hanging out with Bonesman. But this is something that was posted July 3rd, 2020 on Crazy Days and Nights. They put this out. This deceased writer, publisher of a well-known magazine that still runs, was also known for having a television show. His manner and speaking style were mocked on sketch comedy shows many times. He preferred sexual relations with men rather than with women. But like a lot of men of his generation, he could not acknowledge this and so married and had children. In addition, the audience he cultivated would not have accepted this. He spent a lot of time with homosexual prostitutes from a specific procurer. He would often tell his favorites that he would refer to them on his TV show by assigning them an obscure word, Latin or Old English, and then use the word on his show that week. William F. Buckley, National Review, Fire and Land.
Now, what you shared about his sort of closet homosexual behavior, has that been vetted and verified, do you know?
Not to my knowledge. I would say that I find this website to really, they predicted a lot of stuff about people like Weinstein and Epstein before they were even public.
Yeah.
So they generally, I find their information to be credible. I think it's definitely kind of a gossipy site, but I found a lot of their information to be to eventually be vetted.
If you get source material, if you get source material like from biographers that confirms that, that's what I've tried to do in my book writing, is get back to the writing of the actual gentlemen themselves. The reason why I find that curious, if that were true. And you know, there's a lot of homoerotic rituals that these our Anglo-Saxon power people have to go through. There's something they call the Princeton rub or the Oxford rub that goes back to the Spartans, where there's a certain sexual act that the senior men in power do to the younger men. And the historians, you know, talk about it all the time. And that has continued. In fact, of all things, C.S. Lewis, the Christian author, in his sort of biographical books, I think it's called Surprised by Joy, he wrote about his time in the British boarding schools, and the upper senior classmen would take in the more effeminate boys and sort of treat them in a similar fashion. But what's curious, if what you read was true about William F. Buckley, is that there's a famous incident that happened in 1968, you may be well aware of, at the Democratic National Convention, that big seminal event in our history with all the riots outside
Chicago,
and the things that went on. Right. And the two analysts that were there was William F. Buckley and his main intellectual rival, Gore Vidal. Right. And these two intellectual giants were on camera. And I don't know if you've seen this or not, but he was not used to having an intellectual peer on show with him. And Gore Vidal could give him all he could handle. Now, Gore Vidal was well known for having homosexual tendencies.
And I think he was outright homosexual,
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is that he was known for that. He was a writer, you know, artist, and that's not uncommon. With Gerald Hurd, I mentioned in my book. Well, anyway, he was having William F. Buckley's lunch on camera and basically had him painted in the corner, and in frustration, you could watch him lose his cool. Buckley lost his cool and just said, "You faggot." And it was on TV. And Gore Vidal just sat back and grinned because he realized he'd won the argument, and he basically
Well, I can tell you two people from this conversation. I mean, also, if you're a bonesman, you do like a resurrection ritual. You get in a coffin and everybody else urinates on you. So this is supposedly like your Christian leader, right-wing leader, man at Yale or whatever, getting pissed on by George W. Bush Sr. probably, and some of these John Kerry, all these other characters. So that's supposedly your that's what you mean. Like, these guys are not, I would say Buckley's not authentic at all, but still speaking for the Christian community. But also an interesting thing about Gore, let me finish my thought. Gore Vidal's, one of his best friends was Tom Dreiberg, who was the head of the Labour Party in the UK, who was supposed to be Aleister Crowley's heir. And that's all written down, and he was supposed to actually be that. And also, Crowley might have made H.L. Mencken a disciple of one sort or another, because Mencken had all of Crowley's signed copies of his books. So there's like a weird undercurrent of Aleister Crowley in our conversation. Yeah.
Well, Mencken was certainly a cynic and a contrarian. So if that went against the normal mores of what he thought was America, I'm not shocked at that. But I think, if I remember correctly, William F. Buckley comes from more of a conservative Catholic background. So he would be the Catholic element of the religious right. And that's why I try to use the term religious right more than evangelical, because you have a merging of hard right portions of Catholicism, even Mormonism, and what we consider Protestantism, the Reformed movement. And then you have elements of all of those that are outside that. But I think he comes from that element of it. So if what you read was true, it's just more than ironic and hypocritical that he would say something like that if he was closeted, but calling such an epithet against Gore Vidal. I wanted to make sure if there's anything that your listeners remember from our talk, is a warning that Gerald L.K. Smith gave that was run at the end of his obituary in the New York Times. This is a quote that he gave in the later part of his life about how he was so successful and became so wealthy with his printing press and all of this anti-Jewish, anti-Black, anti-Catholic material. He said, Gerald L.K. Smith said, religion and patriotism, keep going on that. It's the only way you can really get them heated up. Certain nerve centers in the population will begin to twitch, and the people will start fomenting and fermenting. And then a fellow like myself will have the people with them with hook, line, and sinker. Then I'll teach them how to hate.
Wow, that's incredible. That's a great way to end it. Where can people find this book, Mike?
Okay, this was just a tiny inkling of what I had. I've covered half my material I planned for tonight. And there's much more in the book. It's called Two Masters and Two Gospels, Volume 1, The Teaching of Jesus versus the Leaven of the Pharisees in Talk Radio and Cable News. It's available at all the normal haunts. Amazon has it in Kindle, in paperback and hardcover. Barnes & Noble has it. I think Apple Books has it in ebook. So you'll be able to find it at numerous places like that. But again, there's EPUB versions as well as Kindle for ebook. Lovers, and I have a blog where I write. I'm sorry.
Please continue. I was just about to.
This is the first volume of three. Two of them are almost finished, and I'm going to try to switch back to finishing them up. And there's a lot more disturbing information in the next two volumes that'll be more pertinent to your interest, actually, William. I have a blog in which I include stuff that's more late breaking. Information I throw up there, I may write on it later, but I have very long-winded blog posts. They're like the size of a book. Topics that we could come on the show and talk about, actually. It's called The Two Spies Report. It's named in honor of Joshua and Caleb. It's considered a Christian minority report. It says that, you know, just because a minority of people that love God say something doesn't mean it's wrong. And it's at Two Spies Report, TWO, Spies, SPIES, report.wordpress.com. And even have it has its own Facebook page too. It's Facebook/Two Spies Report with a lot of announcements on there. If you want to learn about other books as they come out and interviews, I find links. In fact, I just put our interviews that I've done with you up on MikeBennettBooks.com. and my publisher, AkribosPress.com, AkribosPress.com. And if you want to walk through nostalgia, you can go listen to my archive of 7 years of Future Quake shows at FutureQuake.com. A lot of those people, I don't believe what was said by other people on the show anymore, but it's there for historical purpose, and you may find some interesting things. Some of those people have died that have seen that show. It's a good time capsule. So that's mostly what I'm up to. And I cannot tell you what a privilege it is to be here, and appreciate you having me.
Well, I love having you on, Mike. It's great to talk with you. Such great information, very unique. And kudos to you for your research, really kind of uncovering these things. The past definitely informs the present. And everybody in America, Christians in particular, should know this information. It's very important. And, I kind of keep reciting that on all the shows. But I do recommend people get this book and read it through. It's definitely worth your while. So, again, Two Masters, Two Gospels. This is our third interview by J. Michael Bennett. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Okay. All right, cool.